My name is Andre Stitt. I was born on the 2nd of March 1958 in Belfast, Northern Ireland. I grew up in Northern Ireland. I left Belfast in 1980 when I completed a fine art degree course at Belfast College of Art and Design.
Can you tell us something about your childhood? What kind of family you come from? What kind of place you came from?
My father was from Northern Ireland, Belfast, Protestant, and that's quite significant in terms of Northern Ireland, in terms of culturally, politically, socially. So my father was from Northern Ireland, but my mother was from Paris, France. And initially, I grew up in a part of Belfast called Donegal Pass, off the Ormo Road, which is a little kind of loyalist Protestant enclave, surrounded by kind of Catholic areas. And then that was in the early 60s, and then sometime in the mid 60s we moved out to new housing estates that they'd been building to in some way take people out of these kind of slum areas of the inner city. So it was your kind of your new build housing estate, satellite places outside of main cities in Britain. So there was this weird situation of being in the city, but also being then in the country or on the edge of the country, which is very interesting for me. But always coming back into Belfast, which is where all my relatives were. So there was a kind of splitting there somehow, where one belonged. So that, what was interesting was that my mother was from France, so that automatically set me apart or our family apart in some way. And then I was called Andre. Now, you don't get like anyone in Belfast called Andre. So, you know, I grew up always feeling kind of in some way having to prove something. Being picked upon because of my name and my, you know, the way my mother was perceived, talking French and stuff like that, which then became something that I rejected, which in some ways I regret. I wouldn't learn the language at school. I wouldn't go to French classes, for instance. But it was quite an odd situation to be in, because my father came from this kind of real working class, not well off at all, had bettered himself through night classes, through trade unionism, became a shop steward, was steeped in Marxism. So I had kind of Marxism on the one side, and then this kind of, my mother being French, in some way there was this idea of culture or art on the other side. But then my father was very interested in that as well. And I remember an early age, when we moved out to this housing estate, and I got to know little kids, and we all became friends and stuff like that. Friends would come around the house, and my father had these little prints of Picasso that he had got from somewhere, that he had framed himself, and he had them on the wall. And I remember these kids coming around and saying like, "Hey mister, is that a Chinese painting?" You know, like it was this kind of cubist thing going on. So it was quite weird, because it sort of set us apart, and at the same time it introduced me to another way of looking at reality, I guess, because even though my father would never have been talking about, for instance, cubism, there were these paintings, you know, little reproductions. And so I kind of started putting two and two together, and I went out and started finding out what this stuff was about. I was also encouraged from a very early age to draw and paint and make art, and that's what I did anyway. It was something that came very, very natural to me. So the foundation of my art practice goes right back to when I was a kid. And I always remember birthdays, Christmases. I would always get something kind of artistic, like pencils, water paints, color paints. An auntie bought me painting by numbers, because I was the artist, you know, and she thought, "Oh, that's what you'll need, painting by numbers." And that was very, I was very young when that happened, and I remember that was kind of the introduction. Although they were mixed up little pots, this was oil painting, you know. And I started painting in oils very young, you know. I got to know myself. I just went out and bought this stuff, you know, saved up pocket money, worked a paper round, that type of stuff. But our family weren't very well off, you know, and I always remember working all the time. It was always like working to get extra something or other. And, you know, it was myself and four other kids, which was quite big for a Protestant family, you know. So that was kind of the background, you know. I had a great childhood. It was, in many ways, it was fraught. There was a lot of trauma in our family. There was a lot of issues surrounding whatever my mother and father's relationship was. My father's problems, which maybe weren't diagnosed at that point, with alcohol. And in fact, you know, I mean, alcohol and later with my own problems, drugs, were kind of prevalent in our background. I mean, it was very much a drinking culture, which could lead itself to violence as well. I'm not saying, yeah, there was a certain amount of domestic violence going on, but certainly growing up in Northern Ireland and Belfast at that point, through like the late 1960s through the 70s, when we have kind of a period of real civil conflict taking place, and, you know, I had friends who were killed. You know, I certainly was in quite a few incidents which left their scar on me. So it was very traumatic. It was very odd, because, and I remember feeling overwhelmingly kind of this black cloud upon everything, quite depressing, but at the same time, paradoxically, really exciting. Mm-hmm. And music played a really big part in my growing up. We always had music on all the time in the house, and I got into music at an early age. I mean, I sort of think that I was very fortunate in that I had this kind of idea of coming out of the 1960s as a child, feeling very optimistic, and then going into this other period where it was very dark, and that seems to be kind of something that's had a profound influence in my life, where I swing from one to the other. I'm incredibly optimistic about things, but there's an underlying darkness or an edge to that. You know, I'm always trying to, I guess, do something better. To contribute something, and maybe saying art, that's maybe why I got into the art, that it was a way to change the world or change circumstances or a way of thinking about the world. And I don't think I saw the world the way that other kids saw the world anyway. Now, that could have been a lot of influences to do with, you know, family background and the way that my mother and father were. But then beyond that, there was definitely something different about me and how I perceived the world. When I talked to other children, it was kind of like they just would look at me very strangely. Really? Some of the things I would say, really? And it was only when they started taking drugs with me that they sort of saw the world in a similar way. I didn't need the drugs, actually. So, yeah, a lot of very profound influences. And as I say, music was a big one, and music is still something that is really kind of an anchor or a foundation even within my art practice now. There's always music going on somewhere, whether it's music in the studio or music in a performance, and how that's used, how sound. I'm talking about music in a very wide sense, the use of sound.
Did you go straight from school to art school?
I did a foundation.
Yeah.
I did a one-year foundation. It was an interesting situation with our school. It was because I go to school reunions, which I find really fantastic. I love them. I love that reconnection with people I went to school with. But I didn't realize until recently at a school reunion, someone said, "Oh yeah, but you were the grammar stream." I went, "What's that?" I thought we were just all in a new modern comprehensive school together. Now, what I'd forgotten was we had an exam called 11 Plus, where if you passed it, you went to a grammar school, which meant you were much more intelligent and good things could happen to you in your future career. I went to your bog standard. Well, it was a new secondary modern school. But through that, I met teachers who were very young, That was at the tail end of the 1960s. They were very optimistic about what they could do through education. I had a really great art teacher. You know, our art classes weren't the same as other people's art classes in other schools. He was really on the money in terms of contemporary art at that time. Mm. I mean, you know, I was being introduced to pop art, David Hockney, stuff like that, that was current at that point, you know. And I always knew I wanted to go to art school.
Mm.
That was what I was going to do. So I, most of the people I went to school with left school at 16 and went off and got jobs in factories and things like that. We had this small cohort of pupils who stayed on and did A levels. They were a kind of sick form, which were a higher and lower sixth combined. Very small, only about six or seven people. And I was part of that, and that's why they were laughing about this being the grammar stream, where we were being groomed to do these. We were being groomed to go to university, basically. Mm. And I didn't know that at the time. So anyway, to cut a long story short, that's how I ended up with Foundation. That was my kind of university route, if you like. And then through Foundation, I decided to go to Belfast School of Art and Design because of what was happening at that point in the Troubles. And I thought that through art, I could make a contribution somehow, some way to try to understand this situation or to bring a dialogue to this situation. Of civil conflict in Northern Ireland. So I stayed for that reason because a lot of my friends at Foundation went off to England. And that was the route for many people. People wanted out of that really bad situation during the Troubles to go somewhere else, go to England, somewhere like that.
Mm.
So I stayed on, and one of the other reasons I stayed on was I started making what I was calling action art during Foundation. They were very, very simple things, like I would walk around with like a constable, like the Heywood by Constable, like a framed picture around my neck. And then I had the word boring stenciled across it. And I'd just walk around like that all day. And I did a whole series called Boring, where I'd walk around and around the city, I'd write on the wall, this wall is boring at 10:30 a.m. on this date, blah, blah, blah. And do those kind of, you know, very rudimentary kind of actions about the environment in some way. So I knew I wanted to do something like that, and the painting that I was doing was very much large physical abstract things, gestural, probably influenced by people like Pollock and de Kooning, abstract expressionist. And so, you know, all that was kind of combining to go somewhere else. And at that point as well, my Foundation, I saw Alistair McClellan make a performance in the street in Belfast. And those things came together. And I thought, okay, he's at the main art school. I'll apply there and see where this stuff's going to take me. So I went to the art school in Belfast and really just started making my own way through what this stuff was. I hadn't heard of performance art at the time. This would have been 1976, 77. Lots of changes culturally. I was involved in, again, music through having being in a punk band. So punk rock, things like that were very influential at that point. Basically started making performances, which I called actions, in the street. I did make some in the art school, but they really didn't want it to happen there. There were problems. So I just thought, well, that doesn't matter anyway. That's not where it's happening. That's not where real life is happening.
Mm.
It's happening out there. That's where I'm going to make it. And Alistair was the example of that.
Mm.
And so I just started making my own work. The first thing that really influenced me in terms of performance art was a copy of Studio International, an issue which was a major art magazine at that time, I suppose equivalent to what, Art Forum, Freeze, something like that. And it had an edition on performance art. That was very influential. It had, I've got a copy of it there. I actually managed to get this years later.
Yeah.
It's a pretty good mint condition. Mm. I'm not sure how much it cost, but this was the original from 1976. And it has like Genesis P. Orridge in it, people like that, Hugh Adams,
yeah,
on British performance,
yeah,
art. Voices Coyote. But this series here by Genesis Peorage and Sleazy Christofferson called Annihilating Reality was really, really influential for me, because it was a lot of little bits about odd behavior in terms of what performance might mean. So it went from like Iggy Pop and rock music to shamanism, you know. So there were all these to mass murderers like Charles Manson. It was like all these things, and I thought, wow, so all these things are connected, you know. It's not like we're sitting in an art school and it has to be about some sort of refined performance for a little audience, you know. It's like it really can be out there, and it can be incredibly subversive and as covert as you want. You know, you wouldn't have to like even necessarily advertise it like a theatrical event. You could just go and do something. It was real. It was part of real life, you know. And that's what fascinated me by performance art. The other thing that happened was I discovered in another book or magazine, I don't know what book it was or magazine, an article on the Viennese Actionists, Günter Bruce, Otto Muhl, Rudolf Schwarzkogler, and the photographs of Rudolf Schwarzkogler really completely changed the aesthetic of what I was doing. And it was exactly what I was looking for. It was something that was being transmitted through the photography that I realized I wanted in some way to reflect or replicate, even in a live situation. And so I set about making these odd surgical performances, which were completely really wrapped up in what was going on in terms of the violence in Belfast at that time as well. So basically, you know, started making performance, got into a lot of trouble. At one point, to really make the shift from this kind of studio-based work into what I saw as a more radical way of making work through live performance manifestation in a live context, I took all my paintings on the studio and burnt them in front of the art school, which is slap bang in the middle of the city centre, and got a lot of attention from the British Army, the police, the fire brigade came, it was in the local papers, and got me into a lot of trouble. And they wanted to basically kick me out of the art school. And what I found really amazing was there were a couple of tutors who stood up for me, Alistair and Adrian Hall. Adrian Hall, who was head of sculpture at that point, said that he would walk out of his job if they slung me out, basically. And I thought, that's amazing. And so they didn't in the end, you know. So I owe Adrian Hall a lot in terms of supporting me through that. It didn't necessarily stop me from doing what I was doing. I just went and did it somewhere else, basically. But it was that point where I said, right, actually, I'm not painting. This is me saying no to tradition. I'm off. I'm getting involved in something else. And I started making works around Belfast in lots of derelict sites on the streets. It was very much about being sighted within the community.
Was it dangerous?
You know, it's something that never even occurred to me. It probably was. But you were so used to dealing with that situation day by day that it didn't really matter. It didn't feel. It was just like, I knew I wanted to do this, so I was doing it. A few times, you know, picked up by police, whatever. And yeah, there were a few nasty situations. Scary, in fact. One in particular, I remember a whole patrol of British Army just running towards me with their guns and dogs. For some reason, no, the dogs belonged to the community, they were part of the community, but the dogs were running out of the houses as the Brits were running up the street after me, and they were just like coming at me with their guns, just pointed at me, you know, and it was just like, oh, right. But, you know, it's like a kind of, I was only 19 or 20 year old, it was like youthful exuberance, and I didn't really think about it. And up to that point, we'd all lived through quite a few years of this stuff going on that, you know, you didn't feel good about it, but it was kind of like, well, you dealt with it really on a day-to-day basis because you didn't know what was going to happen next, you know. So maybe it was dangerous in some level. However, I also started making works, and in particular, a series of works over about 8 or 9, maybe 10 months in a derelict church, which was at the corner of our street in Belfast. So there was this church that I remember when I was a kid, when I actually lived in the street before we moved out to the housing estate. And there were still members of our, you know, relations and stuff, my aunties and stuff around that area. But this church had kind of just fallen into, it hadn't been used for years, and gradually people were robbing it and stuff, lead and taking things out of it. So it was pretty derelict. I just started making performances in it, because it kind of rooted me right in that community. And I was able to kind of act out all sorts of kind of little psychodramas, if you want, in relation to my feelings about that community and what was going on and what had happened before in that area. So it was interesting making all that work. It's interesting also that years later, in 2000, I was commissioned to make a piece in Belfast, and I decided to make this work, which would start at that street where my family were, and at that, this whole area had changed. But this old church that I had used had then been converted into a Chinese restaurant. I crawled on my hands and knees across Belfast from this point to a pub where my father used to drink in. And my father had just died previously, about a year before, and I wanted to make this kind of journey for him, very personal, but very public as well. Quite an extraordinary performance, I think, for me. But I had this idea that perhaps I could go into this Chinese restaurant and maybe they'd have an exhibition of these photographs of me in this church making these performances. And I did attempt to do this, but they thought I was completely mad. When I made a kind of retrospective show in Belfast in 2010, which was an exhibition of objects and ephemera connected to performances that I've made over the years, we did make a video of us having dinner in the Chinese restaurant and talking about where things had happened in the restaurant and showing pictures to the waiters of what had taken place. So there was a group of me and a bunch of school kids made a video of different places where I'd made performances in Belfast and stories about what had happened in that area. Which was very interesting doing that later, because it allowed me to see actually how connected I was to that whole area of Belfast, because I made an awful lot of performances directly in the community where I grew up, which, you know, when I thought about it there, I thought that's extraordinary that I was doing that, because I didn't even think about that. Mostly when people were making works, they seemed to be detached from where they'd come from in some way, but this was really rooted right in the community, you know. And, you know, you get my auntie saying, you know, are you going to do that weird stuff again? You know, give it a rest, will you? My father used to say, don't take your clothes off.
What's the first significant piece that you made outside of there?
Well, I moved with Tara Babel was my girlfriend. He also started making performance work, and we started making work together. We moved to North London, Holloway, 1980, and we started making works together on the streets of London. We would dress up as the British Army with toy guns, with ducks on our heads, and these quacker things, and run around the streets of London pretending we were a British Army patrol. So it was always like a kind of sense of humour, I think. Yeah. I think what had happened when we moved to London was there was this kind of a sense of humour about, you know, dealing with that bad situation in Belfast somewhere else, actually the centre of what caused the problem in the first place. You know, London, British government, Parliament, all that. But also a certain amount of fun and humour to deal with that. And I think what came out of those works was probably two performances which became the significant ones of that early part of my career when I moved to London. It would have been a work that Tara and I made together at a club called Cabaret Futura with Richard Strange.
Yeah.
Remember this? 1980, maybe 81. So that idea of placing performance art in a bar, a club, and you'd have some performance art, some weird music, someone tootling or scrunking on their saxophone, someone doing concrete poetry or sound poetry or something, some films maybe. That always really appealed to me, that idea of kind of multimedia event. Really loved that idea. And we've been trying to do that stuff in Belfast, but it never ever really worked. So doing that piece in Cabaret Futura was really important. We showed the documentation of us doing the British Army patrols through the streets of London. And I was shouting out a kind of manifesto about this stuff. And then Tara brings out this rabbit, and I get out a drill and start drilling this rabbit, you know. That's about it. And then someone walked on and started playing a trombone.
Yeah.
You know, so it was this kind of real kind of mixture of stuff going on.
This wasn't the famous rabbit.
It was. I think the rabbit became quite famous. It ended up in The Guardian anyway. That's why I'm saying it was probably the most significant, the first significant one. I realized that here you are out of an art space. Also, you're getting media attention and you're trying to talk about something rather serious, but there's also a kind of a sense of subverting all the boundaries here in some way. So that was quite significant. The rabbit was dead, actually. It wasn't, but, you know, of course, it got spun out in Time Out, The Guardian, The Evening Standard, all these newspapers about, you know, artist actually attacks rabbit with chainsaw.
Yeah.
That's how it ends up, you know. So I thought, well, that's quite good. I see where that's going. I see what you did there. Yeah. So, you know, that was quite significant. And then I think the next significant piece, which was a solo piece at the London Film Cooperative in Camden, which was a series organised by Roberta Graham, an artist who was working at that point. It introduced me into this other performance world because I still felt quite outside. You know, we were squatting. We were part of a kind of younger squatting scene. We were more into playing in bands and doing music and stuff like that. But it introduced me into this other scene through Roberta, Helen Chadwick, people like that. So I got to know that there was this other performance scene. So quite a few people came to that. And I met Rob Lafrenne through that performance magazine. That performance was written about. It was a performance called Dogs in Heat. And it was very much about the relationship of what had happened to me in Belfast and what was happening in Brixton during the riots of 1981. So it was kind of a work about that. So that was the next significant one. And that kind of launched me out. I started getting networked and connected to lots of people in London, and then moving out as well. People in Brighton making work at the Zap Club. Again, that was part of that culture of, because the Zap Club, I think at that point, they didn't have a space. They were making work in like upstairs in pubs and bars and places like that. But also getting connected with a group in Leeds who were putting on performance events. Newcastle Upon Tyne with the Basement Group. So, you know, started to travel out and make work. And always felt like I wanted to move further.
Yeah.
And that's basically what happened through the 80s, that, you know, the work got extended internationally and I started travelling to different performance festivals.
Were you aware you had a particular kind of reputation at that time? The people expected something of you?
No.
They just wanted a new work?
No. I think that what I was aware of was that I couldn't quite, in a sense, help them understand what I wanted to do. If that makes sense. It was like, okay, you've got these performance things. I'm applying to you. I want to make this performance. But I guess I didn't have, I didn't know how to write a proposal. As simple as that. You know, maybe the way I was coming to it was rather oblique in some way. It wasn't quite what they expected. But I started getting the reputation for being quite violent in the work, physical, confrontational. And that was fine. I played up to that. The bad boy from Northern Ireland. I mean, yeah, that's what it was about. But I wasn't quite, I couldn't quite get why they wouldn't have it. Why there was a problem.
Yeah.
The sensibility of that didn't, it didn't dawn on me because I simply was out of my experience. You know, I didn't hang around with polite middle-class people, if you like.
Sure.
And I didn't grow up in that atmosphere. I grew up in a very hard atmosphere. It was like fight, fight, fight. And also it's like, you know, my father coming from that background as well. It was like, you know, push forward, fight, you know, get somewhere, say something, do something, change something. You know, it was quite revolutionary in a way. And I guess I was trying to find my way through that.
Yeah, and you never had to ask permission to do it. You just did it.
On the street?
Yeah, everywhere.
Just did it?
Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing that really I find fascinating later in the 80s when I realised that other artists were only talking about commissions, working with galleries or groups to do things. I couldn't understand why artists wouldn't just go off and do it, because that's all I was doing. Because, of course, in Belfast, that's all you could do. There wasn't any gallery where you could make performance art. There was no one interested in it. And that was probably a good thing at that point, you know. But, funnily enough, you saying that now, it was this very strange realization that, well, why wouldn't, if you wanted to make a piece of artwork, why wouldn't you just go out and do it? And why wouldn't you just go and save up your money and spend your own money on doing what you have to do for that? Because that's all I did. And I wasn't well off. I was working all sorts of shit jobs, you know? And I was signing on the dole, and I was working on building sites and stuff like that. But it was all to do with making the art. And I couldn't understand when someone said, oh, I can't make that piece. I can't get a grant to do it. I never had a grant to do anything, you know? And I remember someone saying, oh, you know, you can apply to London Arts Board to get a grant to do your work. And I remember applying for ages, and I just never got any money. And again, it was probably because I was incompetent at writing grant applications, because no one had ever taught me how to do that. I had no idea, you know. I just used to type up a letter like, you know, I'm going to do this here. I need £50. Now I can look back on it and think, yeah, they would just think you were mad. You're going to do what now? You what? You're going to march around Oxford Street with a pig's head? But, you know, interestingly enough, that kind of bad boy persona, if you like. I mean, I did. I kind of played it up as well. But then it was like, it really was who I was as well. I was very angry, you know. I felt, you know, very disenfranchised as well. You know, I felt really on the outside of a lot of stuff. And during the 80s, I started to get commissions to make performances, and I didn't quite believe them, you know. I always thought something was going to mess up. And I thought, oh, they're just doing that because they want something a bit dangerous, but they're going to stop me from doing it at the last moment. And there was always problems about doing something, you know, because it's kind of like, you know, they want to know, oh, what are you going to use? What are you going to do here in this performance? Blah, blah, blah. Oh, you know, you really can't do that. I said, oh, and then I just started saying, well, yeah, okay, I won't then. But I did it anyway, you know. But then they would just like send these letters to the Arts Council complaining about me. And so bit by bit, it was like dismantling any goodwill on one level. That, you know, and just dismantling it, and I just thought, oh, fuck it, who cares? Because I'll just go off and do it myself anyway. Who needs your 50 quid? And that's what happened anyway. The other thing was that when I was in Belfast, you know, if we think about pre-internet email, all that, when I was in Belfast, completely disconnected from mainland Britain. I mean, you know, I used to go over all the time by bunking on the train. I'd get the boat to Liverpool, and I'd bunk the train to London and go to gigs to see bands, right? and squat, play, spend time with people who were squatting, right? But there was no way to know what else was going on. There was no connection, you know? And no one ever came to Northern Ireland, you know? We didn't see anything, you know? We're completely cut off. Adrian Hall, who was the tutor who supported me during, you know, when I burnt those paintings, he said, right, one day he said, oh, you're doing a lot of this photocopying malarkey and doing these fans and stuff. Why don't you send them to this guy in Australia that I know? So I think his name was Terry Reed or something like this. Sydney. I sent a bunch of this photocopy stuff off and forgot about it. Next thing I know, 6 months later, I get this catalogue back. Mail art show, Sydney Art School or something, you know. And there's my work in it. And it has like all these addresses of all these artists around the world. So I start writing to people. And that's how I started networking. So when I went to London and this stuff was kicking off, like, you know, arts counselor kind of, you know, established galleries asking me to do something and then not wanting to work with me anymore because of the problems that they perceived happening out of the work. I thought, well, stuff that then. It doesn't matter. I've got this other network, you know, and I can just go and ask someone in America, can I come over and do a gig, you know? And it was like, you know, it's weird thinking about it now. I didn't have any money, you know? And I just thought, oh, well, I'll just ask him and see what happens and we'll organise it, because that's what you do. And that's what started to happen. I would start to do these little tours around Texas, for instance. I went to New York and did some stuff. You know, got to know people in Belgium, went there and did some stuff. You know, so there's all these little connections. There were like people who had run fanzines, who were who had organised gigs for bands, were, you know, hooked into the music scene, running sort of art events on the side, but trying to, you know, bring things together wherever they were, you know. So I remember going over and doing a tour with Kurt Cran. Like, Kurt Cran made all the early films of the Viennese Actionists. He ended up living in Houston, Texas, and working as a security in the Houston Contemporary Art Museum.
Wow.
Right. And he's got all these big rolls of films of, like, you know, Otto Muhl, you know, Hermann Nietzsche. Right. So we just do the series of gigs around clubs in Texas. Texas, for God's sake. He goes on, shows his films, and then I come on and do my stuff. You know, like, whatever, you know. You know? And that's what we did, you know. And that was organized through a guy called Dan Plunkett, who ran a magazine called ND, which was like New Dimension or New Direction or something like that, which dealt with, you know, this guy was writing about Paul McCarthy before anybody had heard of him, you know. You know, he was writing about all these guys. So he befriended Kurt. You know, because he knew who the Viennese Actionists were. So you would have these pockets, these little, you know, people who were doing these little things, you know. So that whole thing about funding, commissioning and all that, I just thought, who cares?
Do you think it made the work stronger? Because I'm thinking about it's not like we are up to our armpits in curators and internet now. Is the work any stronger? Because it seems to me you're talking about a kind of power in the work that comes from people who are going to do it anyway. And there's a great passion in that, and you share that passion.
I think it's a passion, isn't it? But then again, if you think back in the 80s when there was this kind of... there was a transformation of performance art into live art, which is very much about commodifying it or packaging it, and that was very much driven by the Arts Council of Great Britain at that point. It wasn't England, it was Great Britain, wasn't it? and that was very much about bringing in experimental theatre groups so that places like theatres, galleries could book something and they knew what they were getting, it was packaged, you know, and it would be repeated. Exactly.
Yeah.
Now, that isn't what I was interested in doing. That isn't what a lot of artists were interested in doing, you know? So I think you're right. There was a passion in what maybe we were doing. And it's not like I'm anti-experimental theatre because I love experimental theatre or anti-live art and all that silly debate about it. It's just something that happened. And I didn't ever feel a part of that. I felt there was something else, another world out there. You know, and I was being taken into it and around it. And I always thought that there were many individual artists who kind of became part of that world, of the live art world, And I always felt they were losing out, that they weren't really making their best work.
Mm.
And they were actually missing out as well on the experience. You know, there was a kind of, it felt more solitary to be in a network of live art than it did to be somewhere else. The networks that I was in were, you know, I was connected, you know. I'd always some floor to sleep on, you know, and I'd travel around the United States or wherever, or Europe, you know, and be connected into that, you know. It, you know, I suppose the question is also passion versus professionalism on some level.
Yeah, but perhaps it's also to do with who arrives in the audience. Who are they? They may be completely other people.
Well, this is the thing that I always liked about it was, and that's why I always liked doing those multimedia things. Mm. We did quite a lot of that around London as well, that it wasn't your art crowd. It was like a bit of art crowd, a bit of music crowd, a bit of some other people, all age groups as well, you know?
Mm.
You know, the kind of, the demographic was very, very wide in a sense, you know? So you didn't really know who was going to turn up, you know? And I'm thinking the stuff in the United States, it's a bit like that as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, really?
Is it the kind of last breath of the avant-garde?
What, now or then?
No, then. Then.
Then.
I mean, I can't think of anything now that's that. I mean, it's independent. It's happening because it is going to happen.
Mm.
And it's certainly in advance of things.
No, I think that's still happening.
Hmm.
I mean, you know, it's. I'm not going to say that it's deluded, but or deluded. it might be deluded, but there are still pockets now, and I can think of, you know, a few groups who are doing stuff now. So there's still a younger generation. And the thing that I've noticed over the years, I don't know if you have noticed this, is that there's just always somebody coming in to kind of do the next thing.
Yeah.
And it's still happening, you know. You got Performance Space in Hackney, you got We up in York. It's like, you know, we've got stuff always happening here in Cardiff, you know. So, you know, it's always there. And, you know, those younger artists, you know, they're plugged in, they know what they're talking about.
Sure, no, I know that.
And they've no illusions about the kind of the financial aspect of it, you know, or that their work is dependent upon that. I think it's they can play off that, you know. And if I was younger and knew how to do that when I was younger,
I
would have done that as well, most certainly,
sure,
you know.
Sure.
But, you know, they do it very well.
Hmm.
Yeah. So maybe there's just a little bit of oven without the guard.
Tell us about another significant work that surprised you. One of yours that kind of came out of the blue. Because it seems to me your practice really invites that to happen. You're testing yourself with every piece you make.
Mm. Very, very difficult. There always seems to be those moments over the years that come out of the blue. And, you know, they're not planned. There's no way you can plan. They just happen.
Yeah.
So they're more about moments than whole performances, I think.
Mm.
And it's almost like a series of performances lead up to that moment. For whatever reason, something happens. A lot of very intimate moments happening, although there can be a kind of chaos about the performance or those sorts of performances I used to do in the 80s and 90s, perhaps. There would be these moments where you would think, even though this is very aggressive and confrontational, something very sensitive is happening. You know, like a member of the audience coming out and hugging you in the middle of a performance. In the middle of this mayhem and having something happens.
Yeah.
And it stops the whole thing.
Yeah.
And everybody is just like, everybody's together. It's those moments that I always remember, those moments where something happens, where it's almost like time just stops and all our prejudices and whatever we are become one, and we're just there at that moment.
Mm.
1997, my friend Roddy Hunter had organized the Root Festival in Hull and had organized for myself to do a performance in the Ferens Art Gallery. and they had made a large platform, which was at an angle where I had to traverse this platform, and it was covered in oils and blood and all sorts of stuff, and I was on ropes trying to, you know, and I was slinging these buckets of blood on this platform, and the performance was supposed to end with Susan Phillips, actually, who won the Turner Prize last year, coming out and singing, what was she going to sing? Keep the Red Flag Flying High. It was like, you know, it was this total kind of, you know, this is my community and this is where we're at. And she came from the same sort of background and she was going to come out and sing this thing. And she was keyed up waiting to do this thing. Anyway, I'm chucking this blood and stuff, and there's spotlights on this stage, loads of electrics down the back, there's sound going on, really loud, very industrial, and then everything just goes total blackout, because of course all this blood and shit had gone down the back and blew out the whole of the Ferrans Art Gallery. Everything in the building had tripped, right? Total blackout. You couldn't see a thing. So we're standing there in the dark, and I'm kind of like, all right, it's just stopped. I have to stop. And then I can't remember what happened next, but somewhat a torch appeared, and someone gave me a torch to see what I was doing. But there was dead silence. This was the odd thing about it. And I just started talking, like almost with the torch under my, you know, like Halloween, the torch under your chin. You know, I just started talking. And I just started talking about what this meant to me, what I was trying to do, and about the sense of loss of a community, feelings of loss and not belonging, and trying to somehow reconstruct or construct something new, feeling very much lost in this. And then I started talking about us being in this room. And I said, like, we're here together. This is it. It was almost like, imagine this is the last moment we have. It was really like that. And it was so quiet. And I started saying, like, has anybody ever felt so lonely in their life? Like, really, really lonely. And there was a silence. And then this bloke at the back goes, like, I have. And the other person went, like, yeah, me too. And it was just like, what?
Wow.
And people were just going, yeah, I have. Yeah, I feel like that. It was all like that. I said, okay, like, we're not alone anymore. We're here right now. And I said, I'm going to count to three, and then we're going to scream our heads off.
Wow.
I just went one, two, three. I hope it's erupted.
Wow.
And as they were kind of like about 5 seconds into this massive yelling, the lights all went up. It was just the whole building lit up again.
Wow.
It was the most extraordinary feeling, you know. And I remember afterwards the way that people looked at each other, were all smiling at each other and like they all belonged to something, you know. That was an extraordinary moment.
Mm.
You know, really extraordinary. Mm. Yeah. Another, that sort of moment where you have that kind of communion, something stops and there's that moment where everything seems so right and belongs together. You know, it really, it feels like, you know, we know where we come from finally.
Mm.
We know that all this stuff that we're involved in this lifetime, it doesn't matter a shit. We know where we come from and what we're made out of. Mm. We are the star stuff.
Mm.
We are the kind of the stuff here. Mm. We're all the same.
Mm.
That's the leveler was there, you know. And something similar happened when I made a performance in Sydney, Australia at Art Space called Dingo, which was based on the Boys piece I Love America and America Loves Me called Coyote. So I transferred that to the Dingo. So I think this was 3 or 4 days I was in this cage with this dingo. And it had those moments where I was absolutely with this animal. It was the most amazing, beautiful experience. And really, something really shifted in me in relation to other living things, you know, the way that this animal allowed me into her trust, you know, because dingoes don't want, you know, can't read or believe. Dingoes don't want anything to do with human beings. It's like, fuck off. You know, we don't want to eat your babies. Like, just go away. You know, you're the trouble.
Very wisely.
You know? So we had a female dingo called Wandy, you know, who had her own set of problems. And, you know, I had to build up this relationship to gain her trust. And in the end, she was performing in me as much as anything. You know, the, what was taking place in the cage was just amazing, you know. The way that she would follow me about, but then suddenly I'd realise, like, hold on a minute, she's suddenly in front of me. I'm following her. It's just these things happening, you know. And it was almost, like, playful, but very, very quiet. Very, like, a silence to it. And then we'd lie in this straw and we'd sleep together and we'd get, you know. And she was not a dog. I mean, she was a partially domesticated or domesticated dingo. You know, she wasn't a wild dingo, but she definitely didn't trust human beings, you know. So that was really, and in the end, she didn't want to leave. That was really heartbreaking. You know, it's such a beautiful animal. Really, really extraordinary.
Teaching, going from dingoes to students, you've put a hell of a lot into teaching. You're well known for this. You pull a lot in through many different strands, but you put in a lot in to make it possible for other people to make performance and for other people to be taken serious, to be making performance and to bring performance screaming, well, actually not performance screaming, but education screaming. You've brought it right into the middle of education. From what you said, that sounds like a mixture of payback, like something you want to put back in, but also something that you believe fundamentally at the core of. So you've had to kind of do a little bit of that paperwork to be able to do that. Is it still as important to you now? I mean, you've done it.
The system makes it very difficult to do. It burnt me out, actually.
You don't look burnt out.
Well, I feel burnt out. No, I got to a point probably around, what was it, around 2007. So I started in 1999 as head of the time-based department at Cardiff School of Art and Design. And transformed that on some level. And opening Trace in the house here was really part of that, so that students could actually get an experience of something that wasn't... The problem was that they were saying whatever happened in the school is something they had to go and do or had to go and see because it was good for them. I was saying, no, this is available. It would be really great if you went to see it, because you know what? These people are coming from all over the world. And, you know, you're getting, you know, exposure to something that a lot of people would be very envious of. So why don't you come along and see? So, you know, it was in their own time. They had to make that decision. And I never forced them to do it. But, you know, they would come and see work here in Trace. And then their own practice, you know, benefited from that. And we were also then able to translate that into the teaching, of course. But I think trying to juggle up work in an academia and Trace... and all my other work as well, because I was also doing my own solo work, just burnt me out. I got to the seventh year of it, and I just was completely burnt out. Very difficult. I struggled on for another year with Trace programming it, and then felt that was enough. And then started to work with, actually, many of those students who graduated several years before, became part of a collective, and making performances with them as Trace Collective. But it didn't kind of, not only really work for a couple of years, it's very difficult to sustain. But then that's kind of the natural evolution of these things. People split and move off. And, you know, a lot of people didn't want to live here. That's fair enough, you know. But I think it's very difficult, and it's increasingly difficult to bring... external influence into academia. I might be very naive, not maybe it always has been difficult, but I certainly in my experience found it easier over, say, at least 10 years to do that. I don't feel that way anymore. I feel it's very controlled and very difficult to, in a sense, do anything spontaneous.
Sure.
You know?
But people didn't actually believe art schools were anything to do with academia.
Well, yeah, I know.
That's what kept them safe.
But this is then a debate about what art schools are, you know, because I think that what's happened over the last 10 years is that that's transformation of art schools into academia and being part of universities. Mm. And that's where we find ourselves. Now, there's pluses and minuses about that as well. Yeah. There's some good things can come out of that, absolutely. But I think there's a lot of, actually, it doesn't weigh up for me. So I've kind of detached and backed off a bit from my influence in terms of externally what I do into the academy or into the art school for that reason. Because it demands an awful lot of work to make something happen, and then it isn't really appreciated.
Mm.
It's not really understood, I don't think.
Mm.
You know, I feel that, you know, there's something that I actually felt in art school in Belfast, that it's almost hermetically sealed against the world, you know.
Yeah.
It's another kind of world, and it's not a world where I feel comfortable at all. And, you know, I know I'm a professor, and I know that certain academics think that's like an amazing position to be in, but it really doesn't mean an awful lot to me, you know. You know, so which has had an impact on my own practice as well, and the way that my practice has changed. You know, I still really love performance, but I also feel that I'm not seeing enough good performance, and I don't know why that is.
Mm. You know? Is that internationally?
Yeah, internationally.
Mm.
I think there's a lot of bad work out there.
Mm.
That might be an old codger saying or something, you know, grumpy old performance artist, you know. But you know, because that's also something to do with a kind of globalization of the form, which maybe you were hinting about in terms of networking.
Mm.
So it's kind of become homogenized and kind of, oh, anybody can do that because look, it's all on YouTube.
Yeah,
you know. But, you know, there's a fundamental misunderstanding about what performance is or what it can do or what it's about.
Yeah.
You know? I think over the last 10 years, participating in so many international performance festivals, that's really where I felt my heart sink.
Yeah.
Where it's just this treadmill of, like, silly stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, there's good stuff as well, but a lot of it is just, you know, there's no discipline in it. Or very little discipline. You know, it's like, you know, people turning up and just kind of doing their little act.
Mm.
And it's not very good. But like, if you really want to be a light entertainer, go and do it properly, you know. It's not performance art. So I don't feel like I've been moved by anything for very... I suppose, you know, having Trace was a way for me to bring that into my life. And because I'm not doing it anymore, that's what I miss. It enabled me to see a lot of wonderful artists because I was choosing them because I knew they had quality.
Yeah.
And because I respected them and I tracked them and I knew their career and I knew what they were doing and I knew their concerns and issues and whatever they were dealing with and that they were passionate about what they're doing. You know, it amazes me looking back over that 10 years really of doing Trace or 11 years of doing Trace that the artists that I curated, but that we work with as a group, because it's not just me. You know, there were probably about two artists who were really, who really fucked up, basically. And the rest were just absolutely dynamite, really amazing stuff. Mm. And I feel very privileged to have been able to actually offer somewhere where that could happen, because this is also a problem with the performance festival cycle, is that you're not able to concentrate on what you're looking at.
Yeah.
With Trace, you got one artist.
Yeah.
They get to use the space in whatever way they want. You have that dialogue with them. You know, that's going on all the time. What's going on? What's it about? What you can do? What you maybe think about? Maybe that might be difficult. Maybe we need to do something else. You know, it could be anything from someone wanting to take the windows out of the building, Well, the problem with that is it's our house, and I have to pay, and I can't afford it.
Yeah.
It's a little bit, and they're like, oh, well, we'll not do that, then we'll try something else, you know? But we've done quite a lot of very interesting, radical things here, you know? So maybe that's what I miss, that sort of passion. And being that close to performance artists one-to-one, where it's not just a whole bunch of people, and everybody's kind of running around and nobody really knows what they're doing. Because that's what I often feel at festivals.
You said earlier Alistair had significantly changed when he retired. He had taken off a cloak, was holding him down.
Alistair's cloak.
When are you taking off your cloak? It must be within sight.
No?
I mean the teaching. I mean stepping out of... Stepping back into
the job?
Stepping back into only your space.
I don't think so. I've always been very adept, and I think even if I wasn't teaching, it would be the same. That, you know, all those years living in London, I was working on building sites.
Mm.
You know, and that was really tough going. Or landscape gardening. You know, very physical work, but that was tempered by the fact that I knew that it had a purpose, which was the chinks or the bits in between words where I made the work, the art, the real work.
You own them.
Yeah. And that's, you know, I look at the job as being necessary for me to do what I want to do.
Okay.
You know, and that's why I have to do it. You know, and that affords me somewhere decent to live, somewhere where artists can come and hang out with me. But also I have a big studio I can work in.
Yeah.
And that's why I got to hang on to the job.
Okay,
But that's a reality for anybody, isn't it?
Yeah, I totally understand.
I mean, there are very few artists who live off what they do.
I totally understand. The thing you still want to do.
What I'm enjoying at the moment is not doing so many performances, but really picking and choosing what I want to do. I felt before it was just, although I was making choices, it was a kind of treadmill, this constant traveling and doing things, and it got kind of tedious, and it wasn't very fulfilling. The last couple of years I've been really choosing where and what I want to do, and that's been very productive for me. I'm more interested in duration work, longer work, and a lot of that has come out of the experiences of Trace, of actually creating the installation out of the action. You know, that the process continues, and there's this kind of residue which kind of has a life as well. You're making that, you're composing something. The composition. Alistair and I talked a lot about this last year. We made a piece in New Zealand. We talked a lot about the working through and being aware of composing the space, making the composition as the installation. I'm more interested in that. What's also happened is a kind of reflection on the materials that I've been using over the years in performance, and it's painterly quality. The painting never left me.
Mm-hmm.
It just became a kind of bigger thing, you know, in spaces, architectural spaces, galleries, streets, whatever, built environments, natural environments, and that's translated itself into a real interest in what painting is about itself. And I've gone right back into, you know, using a lot of those materials I used in performances initially to make paintings or paint with as a material, but now to actually work with the traditional oil painting as a medium, and pushing and pulling that around the large canvas as a performance space.
Do you think maybe you're becoming French at last?
French? What's that?
Sorry, Kevin.
I don't even know what that means. Becoming French?
No, I'm just thinking
French at last?
From the beginning, your reaction to French at school because of your French background. It's
well, is that like all French people paint or something?
No, there's a kind
of... They're artists, those French.
There's a Matisse. There's a kind of...
But the weirdest thing about that is it's
I'm
like...
I'm just enjoying myself.
Well, yeah, but I don't even think that, you know... I think that probably American art has been more influential in me than French art. You know, always been very much more interested in what was happening right now rather than what has just happened. Sure. Or it's contemporary work, you know. And I think it's fascinating looking at painting in that respect. What's it do? How does it lie? You know? Well, you know, can you really make a painting anymore? You know, all those problems about painting that, you know, people are forever banging on about, you know? I'm endlessly fascinated by what happens when I'm in the performance space, in the studio, which is the canvas, and the paint, and what's going to happen, you know? And all everything I've learned through performance happens in that space. I don't approach it, I don't think, the way other painters do. And I've tried talking to other painters. The other thing that's very difficult is that other painters don't bloody talk, you know? They don't have, there's no dialogue. Now, that's really extraordinary, because with performance artists, there's dialogue all the bloody time. And I miss that. I want to talk to some other painter who can bloody well talk about it, you know? And maybe they can't.
That's what gives your painting the freshness.
Maybe. But, you know, or maybe, you know, it's just the... You know, actually, I've always loved David Hockney. I think David Hockney's great. No matter what people say about it, I think he's fantastic, because he's willing to have a go with anything. And, you know, he's a bloody good painter. I just love what he does and what he, you know, he's very simple and straightforward about it, and he's always excited about it. And I think that's what it is. I'm excited about whatever it is I'm doing right now, in the present moment, in space and time. This is where I am.
And always have been.
Yeah, that's what I mean. It's just, this is what I do. You know, and that way it's time based, it's right here and now, you know. The interesting thing for me about painting is that it is like that duration performance for me. And there are periods of great reflection where you're with the work. And I really love that, man. I think it's really precious. And in a sense, that's what I was trying to do with Trace. To have that extra time with the residue, with the trace of something. You know, when artists would make something, of course, it was left for 3 weeks before the next artist came in. And so we'd be living with it in the house. It's an artwork. It's happening in your house. And you just kind of, you know, you come in late from work, tired. You walk past, look through the doors and kind of go like, oh, there's that thing in our house. Or people would come. The one that always got me was because it was people could phone up and say they'd like to see the work, they can come, Brian, when we're going to organise for someone to be here for them. We'd forget that we're in there. Me and Eddie would be having our dinner, and I forgot they'd let somebody into the gallery. And then they go, hi, and who's these people? You know, we're having our dinner, you know? But the great thing about that was it allowed people to have time to contemplate whatever was going on. And they might have been people who had seen the performance and come to check up on the installation or the residue afterwards, those traces. Or there might have been people who just came in to see the traces, for all I knew. But, you know, you come in, you'd have a conversation with them often. Maybe they'd have a cup of tea. You know, maybe they go straight in, you forget about them. Maybe they go. Wonderful, you know, to have that. And that's what I'm finding with my relationship with paintings about that. You know, that you kind of come and go with it. And, you know, the residue of what's happened out of that process of painting. You know, as a performance, as a process, you know, whatever comes out of that, you know.
Yeah, makes sense.
You know, so definitely coming from another angle from most painters, you know. I'm not interested in representational painting or figurative painting at all. That's probably why, for lack of a better kind of word, it's a kind of abstract genre painting in some way, you know. Very ambiguous. But I kind of like that about painting, that you could be that ambiguous about it, that there are no rules anymore, no matter what anybody thinks, you know?
And it's probably the conversation from everything that happened in Trace that you take to your studio anyway.
Yeah, well, it's that great thing that, was it John Cage said? When you enter your studio, you enter with the whole world. There's this whole conversation going on. All these people are with you when you enter the studio. And as you begin to work, they leave one by one, and if you're really lucky, you leave.
Andre, thank you.